When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and a very warm welcome to another edition of the Liz Our Wellbeing Show, the weekly podcast that is jam-packed with wellness wisdom that you can trust. And today's episode is on that vitally important topic of our mental health. Ben West is an activist and campaigner who's been at the forefront of supporting young people with their mental health ever since his 15-year-old brother Sam took his own life in 2018. Now, Ben West has written about his experiences in This Book Could Save Your Life, which is out now. And as a warning, in this episode, we will be discussing mental health and suicide in a very frank and open way. So if this conversation isn't for you right now, there are plenty of other episodes in the series that are lighter in tone. Ben, a very warm welcome to you. And I actually know about you through my daughter, Brella, who I think connected with you over Instagram while at university when she was doing some work with mental health awareness herself during lockdown.
Yeah, hi, Liz. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah, I think I've known Brella for a year around that, and obviously spoken to her quite a lot about mental health, particularly around universities and support that's on offer in universities as sort of part of what I'm doing with young people around their mental health.
Well, congratulations firstly on the book.
Thank you.
You mention in the introduction to the book that writing it was clearly something that you had never expected to happen. How was the process of writing it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's quite a funny joke, actually, with my friends at the moment, because I was the least likely person in my friend group to have become an author. I was given extra English lessons at school. I was told not to bother sitting my English exams at school because I was always considered to be behind in terms of English. I was much more of a sort of maths side of the brain person. But I guess for me, you know, obviously the experience I had was awful. And the last 4 years I've spent trying to understand mental health, trying to understand suicide, and I've spent so much time trying to build that understanding, talking to people, understanding this space. I've often said I'd love for everyone to have gone through what I've gone through, in that they've met the people I've met and experienced what I've experienced, but without having to have lost a loved one. And so for me, when I was given the opportunity to write a book, I was given that opportunity to take people on that path and give people the knowledge that I've now got that's totally transformed my life. The writing process, though, was a strange experience. As someone that hasn't written a lot in the past, it was a bit of a learning curve. But for me, a lot of the time, I was talking about things and really sitting with thoughts that I hadn't sat with before, alone, on my own, last summer, writing it. Having to sit there with some really uncomfortable things and go through it. For me, it was almost a form of therapy, really analysing how I was thinking and putting it on paper. And I think when you read the book, you can sort of see that thought pattern and analysis go along through the narrative. It was a very therapeutic experience for me and something I'm so glad I did, because it got out of my system so much that I needed to get out.
Well, very interesting. And there's a couple of points there actually to pick up on. First of all, congratulations on being a best-selling author when you were the boy least likely to actually succeed in your English exams. I think also it shows actually what we are capable of, even though we might not think it. And also, I guess we're not all going to go on and write books about our own personal situations. But for me, it kind of highlights the point of the process of processing information. People talk about journaling, don't they? And writing things down. And I guess when you're in that situation, when you have to commit pen to paper or finger to keyboard, it does make you think about things in perhaps a slightly more in-depth way.
Oh, definitely. And I've said a few times actually since we launched it, I really forgot that people were going to read it. It wasn't a book that I was writing. I mean, my editor probably have some things to say about that, but I wasn't writing it in a way that was for anyone else. Obviously, I wrote the book and I started writing the book because I thought, oh, how good would this be to give people this information to help people in this way? And I got to the end of chapter one and I started chapter two. And I just sort of thought, you know, this is doing far more for me than it is for anyone else. And I really hope that it's helped people. And from what I've heard so far, people have really found it useful, but it's helped definitely. Me to no end. And this is the same thing, what you were saying. It's like, you know, most people are not going to go and write a book about that experience, but it doesn't mean you don't have the opportunity to do that. It doesn't mean that, you know, you can write an entire book and people not read it. And I tell you what, the benefit of doing that is huge. And I've started, you know, as a result of writing this book, I've kept going and I'm writing about things that I'm going through now. And not because I ever imagine it being published or anyone reading it, but because it's such a good way of making thoughts which are incredibly difficult to understand, very difficult to see and picture. It's making them into a physical thing. And sometimes you can get so, you can drown in thoughts because you don't understand them and they take over your whole consciousness. But if you can get them on paper and you can really sit with that and analyze it on paper and you can see it in front of you, this experience or what you're going through, then it becomes a physical thing and you can see it and you can analyze it. And I find that such a good way of dealing with things that I wouldn't necessarily see in front of me as a physical thing. It would be a sort of manifestation of grief or trauma that is now there sitting in front of me on a page. And for me, that's just such a good way of making it digestible and it's like something I can deal with. So I've kept it going.
That is a really interesting comment. And let's just talk about the whole area of mental health for a moment before we have a deep dive into specifics. How common are mental health issues? And do you think it's more prevalent now in younger adults? And frankly, we might all be touched by that, whether it's ourselves, our kids, our grandkids.
This is a really interesting question because you see a lot of different numbers thrown around. I think it comes down to what we think are mental health problems or what's going on with mental health there. I think in mental illnesses, it's a very different. It's very different in that you're diagnosed something. So the rate of mental illness, I think, you know, off the top of my head, it's about 4 students in every UK classroom have a diagnosable mental illness. Wow. But in terms of the sort of wider picture, in terms of the prevalence of mental health issues, I can't think of a single person I know in my entire life that hasn't struggled at some point with their mental health. In exactly the same way that I don't know a single person in my life that I've ever met that hasn't struggled with their physical health. I think we all struggle with our mental health at some point. Where that's, and these are, it's very natural things to go through, right? Breakups, exams, a large number of different things that might go on in your life. I think everyone struggles with their mental health at some point. You know, for me, I like to think of mental health as like a spectrum. You're not at one point of that spectrum for your entire life. You're going to fluctuate above and below a certain line. So I think in terms of who struggles, you know, you'd find it very, very hard pressed to actually find someone that hasn't at some point, which is something I only knew after Sam died. When I started talking to people, when I started talking to my friends and my teachers and my family and my local community, I realized that everyone had something they weren't talking about or something that was going on that they felt that they didn't feel comfortable sharing. And that's really what got me started into the mental health stuff, because I thought, how can we let people just not be candid about what's going on in their life? It's you know, it's a conversation that needs to happen. Let's be honest about the stuff that's not going well. It's quite simple, you know, if it's not going well, let's talk about that.
I think that is interesting. And you say, rightly so, there's nobody that we know that doesn't have a physical health issue or has had a physical health issue in the past or ongoing. And the same with mental health. You know, we are just as much our brains as we are our bodies. Can we talk about what's going on with the world right now? Because we've come out of the most terrible pandemic. We've seen the catastrophic effect of lockdowns on mental health, particularly with young people. And I've have two teenagers in my family who went through lockdown, and absolutely devastating. So I'm very close to this subject. How do you see lockdown affecting mental health and the outcomes of that now?
Yeah, it's a difficult one. I think, well, it was an awful thing to have had to deal with. I think when you look at what the definition of trauma is, I think we have sort of gone through a collective society-wide trauma, and being separated from families, from loved ones, having to deal with the number, the suffering on the news every evening, the isolation, the loneliness. It was an awful, awful time, and the repercussions of lockdown is still very much hitting now. I was at uni during lockdown. I was in third year and I actually left my degree. And I think in part it was because of the way that the world was and the way that I was being forced to live. It was awful. And that's coming from me. And I've spent 4 years working on my
mental health.
I know how to look after myself, you know, through a terrible experience. I've learned a lot about how I function. And the first day I arrived at uni in third year, it was my first day. And I got one of those phone calls from NHS Track and Trace being like, you need to isolate for 2 weeks. My first day. And so I spent the first 2 weeks of third year at uni in my little flat with a kitchen, luckily. And I was just there on my own for 2 weeks. And it was awful. It was so awful. I remember, you know, all those classic lockdown things. I did a 5K one day in my room, just running up and down because I was so bored.
Oh, for goodness sake.
But I was really lucky in that I knew how to look after myself.
Yes.
And I had friends there and I was in a city I knew really well, Liverpool, absolutely love it. I knew how university worked. I knew what my course was. So I was sort of lucky in that respect. And it was around the same time that I was isolating that news came out of Manchester that a young boy, Finn, had taken his own life in almost the same circumstance that I was in.
Oh,
and
my goodness.
I cannot tell you. I spoke to Finn's family and his friends. Again, another student took his own life at university during lockdown. I spoke to his friends. Another girl I know took her own life during lockdown at university. I spoke to his
mum. It's absolutely shocking. I mean, Brella also, she got very involved with helping mental health for students at Exeter, where she was, because the same thing had happened with a member of her circle. And it is just beyond devastating that this kind of happened. And has it left any kind of legacy now within young people's mental health moving forward? Is this something that we can kind of move on from and close the door and put behind us? Or is this something that we still need to be really carefully aware of?
I think it's a little bit too soon to say. Some of the research that I've seen has said that it's actually okay, it's getting better, and some of it's definitely not. I think, if anything, it's taught us something. And I was involved in some research during the pandemic that I do talk about in the book. Is I was involved with some research with Accenture where we surveyed 12,000 university students, current university students. And some of the stuff that was found in that, I can't remember the exact figures, but it was around 45% of students said they'd felt suicidal before. There was a figure of, I think it was 80% of students felt lonely either every week or every day. These were really bad, really bad. It was a really awful thing to have found. So I think let's close the door on COVID. Let's move on. But I think we need to take the lessons that we learned from that forward. And I was really surprised. Like, I do a lot of work around sort of government policy, and a lot of my campaigning focuses on that. And I think now we just need to look at what happened in the pandemic, look at how universities reacted, look at how the government reacted in certain decisions and certain, you know, measures they took, and really reflect and understand why certain things were or weren't done in response to mental health. There was a select committee by the government the other day about, and it was titled, I think, something along the lines of lessons learned from COVID in respect to higher education. And they mentioned mental health, I think it was twice it was mentioned in the hour and a half that they were talking. So it's so, so important off the back of that, that it becomes our priority.
Yes.
And this is something, you know, I go into in the book is what actually needs to change, what lessons needs to be learnt, and why it should be an actual priority. Because like you said, I mean, the number of people that are affected by this and the number of people that you speak to that go, as soon as you mention, oh, this person's taking their own life, the number of people you speak to that are like, oh, like you just did, like, oh, my mm-hmm. daughter's just my friend,
yes,
daughter's friend. It's just yes. unbelievable how many people are affected by this.
Mm. It's very sobering, and I'm very pleased that we have young people like you campaigning at government level and making your voice heard, and behind you 110%, as I'm sure everybody listening is too. Now, you became involved, obviously, in the world of mental health at the beginning because of the tragic passing of your brother, Sam, who was just 15 when yeah. he died. Can you tell us a little bit about what Sam was like?
Yeah, he was so funny. He was so, so funny. He had a great personality. He was always the one that would make you laugh. He'd always be the one at the dinner table that would like find that funny meme or that funny video and then like share it around and have us all in stitches. He was the class clown. He would make the whole, like, his whole classroom laugh. He was like incredibly talented. His art and music, he could paint, which I'm so jealous of now because I wish I could paint. I am so bad at painting, but I really enjoy it. So it's like I paint and then no one can see that because it's so terrible. So I wish I had that talent from him. But he was so talented painting. He was really musical. He composed his own music digitally. Like, he made his own film scores that he would how I don't even know how you start to do that.
Yeah, that's amazing,
right? So, and he was very sporty. Like, I often say, you know, the stereotypical mentally ill person or depressed person, he was the absolute opposite of the stereotype. The absolute opposite. He was outgoing, he was sporty, he had loads of friends, he was talented, he had loads going for him. And I guess for me, that just shows how easy it is to hide something that is so awful behind his bubbly, personable character. It was just such a shock for everyone.
Is that what he was doing, do you think? Was there something that happened that triggered the incident? Or do you think there was a lot of stuff being hidden behind this amazingly outgoing and bubbly facade?
It's really hard. So he was diagnosed with clinical depression in September 2017. So he had a formal diagnosis and he was getting treatment for it. So he clearly had, you know, he had the depression going on. And at home, he was very withdrawn. He wouldn't be involved. He wasn't like him. He wasn't making everyone laugh. He wasn't talking much at dinner. He was spending a lot of time on his own in his room. He wasn't really interacting. You could tell something wasn't right. But at the time, I just thought he was, you know, 15 years old. I didn't know what clinical depression was at the time. I just thought he was 15 years old. Who wants to play happy families at 15? I certainly didn't. So I sort of left him to it. But I always was a bit annoyed because at school, when he was with his friends, he was like old Sam. He was laughing and joking and having fun with them. So, and this is something I sort of, like what a lot of, like I was explaining earlier, is sort of reflecting on certain memories and certain thoughts. I was so almost jealous of how he was in front of his friends because he wasn't like that at home. And sort of now I've realised it wasn't him putting on a mask at home and being stroppy and moody teenager at home. It was actually for him feeling safe to be like that at home and not have the energy.
Right.
And he was putting on that mask, that personality mask, at school with his friends because he didn't want to appear different. I think a lot of people can relate that putting on a mask of someone you used to be or the person you think you were is very easy because it's how you kind of want to gravitate towards yourself. So I think at school, when he was being that funny Sam, that was him trying to hold on to the old Sam, and then at home it would relax and sort of the depression would take hold and sap energy from him. It was very, very obvious looking back now, but it was so, so difficult. Well, I didn't know until I opened that door on the 21st of January to find what I found. I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea it was that bad.
Oh my goodness. And you say it's obvious looking back, but you know, I have five children and four of whom have gone through teenage years. Mm-hmm. One is just looming. And all of them have retreated to their rooms during particularly latter teenage years. All of them have become withdrawn, have become stroppy and difficult and uncommunicative and, you know, a bit of door slamming and you know, locking themselves away for hours at a time, not wanting to chat compared to being the life and soul of the party when they're with their friends. How, as a parent or as a sibling, do we tell the difference? I mean, what would you say? What would you advise? What would you say to people listening, thinking, oh, my goodness, you know, that sounds like my teen. What should I be doing about it?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And like I said, I was exactly the same. I was exactly the same. Door slamming, shouting, arguing, running off. I was exactly the same. And I think most teenagers are, they go through that phase. So that's very normal. But I think the problem, the difference is none of us are, unless we're trained, clinically trained, none of us have the responsibility to diagnose. And our responsibility as family members, as friends, as siblings, as parents, it's not to try and diagnose or work out when something is bad or whether it's normal. I think the priority should just be if they seem moody or stroppy or unhappy in some way, then ask them about it. And if asking them about it, if you sit them down and have a cup of tea or after dinner, ask, you know, I noticed this is what's going on and are you okay? And if you ever need to talk, like, you know, come and talk to me. If you can say that and then they just sort of run off and go, oh, what the hell, and slam a door, then that's fine, okay? But they'll know then that you've asked that question. And I think people overthink this mental health thing quite a lot. You know, if you see someone slumped over in a chair at work, and their face is drooped and they look quite unwell, you're going to go over and you're going to ask them, are you okay? Of course you are, because they might be having a stroke. They could suddenly reanimate and have just been asleep and then go, what on earth are you doing? Or they could actually be having a stroke. And the difference is not, you know, in that situation, you don't have to be a neurosurgeon to go and ask that person if they're okay, just in case they're having a stroke. In the same way, you don't have to be a psychotherapist to go and ask someone if they're okay and make them feel safe coming to you if they're not okay. And I think that's the real difference, because people get quite frightened about the mental health conversation, especially parents and siblings. And I was, you know, I didn't want to ask how Sam was because I was scared of the answer. But the most important thing we can do is ask, so that people know that there is someone they can talk to if they are not okay. And they might be just asleep. They might not be having a stroke, but they need to know that you're the person they can talk to if they are. Then that's the precedent you've got to set. And look, if they turn around and say, you know, actually, I've been really down, I'm really struggling at school, or potentially at school, you know, a lot of the time it's someone's, you know, potentially there's bullying going on, then that conversation opens up and then obviously you can explore that further. But the number one thing is just ask, like you'd ask anyone else if you saw someone else struggling in the world, just ask, because I'd do anything to go back now and ask that question.
Of course. And you are wise beyond your years. There's no question about that. And of course, you were just a teenager yourself when Sam died. But you took it upon yourself to campaign for better mental health awareness and understanding. What took you to that place? How did you get there?
Desperation, to be honest. At the time, I would have genuinely, I think at the time, I would have told you, oh, you know, I've recognised this problem, I want to help. And in part, it is exactly that. You know, after Sam died, so many people I spoke to, you know, the messages were, I'm really not okay either. I've got depression, I've got anxiety, I've got anorexia, a whole host of different problems people came to me about. And I was 17 at the time and I saw that and I was like, okay, we got to do something to open this conversation. But so that was one of the reasons. But I think, like I said, desperation, that was the worst moment of my entire life. The weeks after Sam died, I hated it. It was awful because I used to call it, it's like ceremonial sadness. Like everyone just has to be sad. And I am not a serious person. Like I like having a laugh. A lot of my coping mechanisms in difficult situations is to crack a joke and have a laugh with people. Everyone coming around crying and everyone being sad. And I just wanted something good and something positive and something, you know, colourful and happy to latch onto. Because, you know, at the same year that Sam died, I was doing my A-levels, I had to start university, and I was like, I don't want to think about any of that at all. I hate revision. Ben. And so so I started campaigning, and, you know, 4 years later, I'm a little bit too deep to get out. but no, I absolutely love it. And, you know, just to see the impact you can have here, and, you know, be able to start those conversations, get people talking and get people onto the right support that otherwise wouldn't have been able to do that. That's an incredibly, an amazing thing to be able to do, especially because I, you know, one of the reasons I entered this was to stop this happening again and to be in a position to try and do that. Yeah, it's an amazing feeling.
It does feel like, thankfully, people are opening up a little bit more now about their mental health. Is that how you see it, or is there still a real stigma around talking about how you feel?
I think there's massive progress here. It is amazing, and we have to remind ourselves sometimes that we are taking huge leaps here. I think there's huge progress being made in terms of how many more people are coming forward and talking about what's going on for them, how comfortable people feel. That's not to say we haven't still got a lot of work still to do. I think especially as men, there is still a lot of work that needs to happen in terms of getting them to talk, certain generations as well. But I think young people especially, we are getting it right. I think young people are already more open than we've ever been. And that's fantastic. But what that means is a lot more people are recognising that actually things aren't okay. And so the demand for services, the demand for support, the demand for help is going up. In the same way that if you were to start advertising and getting people to check their bodies for lumps and check their bodies for cancer, you're going to see an increase in the number of referrals to cancer units. We're seeing the same thing. And often people confuse that with, because we're talking about mental health, people are becoming mentally unhealthy or mentally unwell. And actually, the truth is, because we're talking about mental health, more people are realising they're unwell. And so what's key now is that we start to adapt to follow that demand, and we start improving access to services. You know, it's not right that people should wait over 3 months to get support for, you know, what we know is a fatal illness. And so I think it's time now to turn that hugely positive attention around mental health and that hugely positive movement that we've got in terms of being open. And we start to work on creating really good, sustainable support systems that can be there for when someone does talk. Because the problem is, if someone talks and there's nothing available, there's really no difference between them talking and not talking.
Sure.
You know, in the same way that having a heart attack and then being told to eat your five a day is not helpful.
That's a very good perspective.
It might be a good preventative, but it's not gonna do any good if you're not having a triple bypass, you're having a salad instead. So yeah, we just need to change that momentum and now create some progress in terms of support as well.
Well, you are obviously an extremely practical person, because at the end of each chapter of your book, there's a section on tips for helping somebody going through trauma. And you offer a wide range of help. You talk about how to deal with depression, how to treat shock, how to perform CPR. I mean, was it important for you to go simply beyond talking about mental health and offer some kind of structured support there?
This is it. For me, the book was, what would I have wanted to have put in the hands of 17-year-old me, or 15-year-old Sam, and all the lessons that I've learned, and, you know, including CPR. You know, I'm so glad that I knew how to do CPR that night, because I'm not sure how on earth I would have coped if I didn't know what to do that night, or you know, what would have happened then. So I'm so glad that happened. And sort of even lessons like that I wish I'd known, or wish people would know if they're in that situation, that I thought was important to do. But also, you're absolutely right, moving this conversation a little bit further along, you know, just giving it like a bit of incentive to get a little bit deeper, rather than simply saying, talk about your mental health. You know, really think about that and ask the questions of, how do we do that? What are some of the things you can say to someone if you're struggling? And then flip it on its head. You know, if it's all good and well saying, talk about your mental health, but if no one's prepared to listen, or if no one offers to listen, then that really doesn't solve any problems. So a lot of the advice is, you know, what can you say to someone to start a conversation if you're worried about them? And it's basically everything that I just think people should know, from CPR to what you can text someone if they've lost a loved one, to all the different things. Every little facet of this conversation, I hope, was my aim to have just ticked off, so that people can read the book and really truly understand mental health awareness, mental health support, what needs to change to improve your life, what needs to change to improve the people around you, and what needs to change to improve society as a whole. And hopefully, fingers crossed, and so far so good in terms of the reviews and what people have been saying, I hope that we've done that, because, you know, it's trying to give that 17-year-old me all the tools that he needed to have tackled that situation just a little bit better, and given a little bit more of a chance for this not to have happened.
Well, you do talk, and of course write, with such authenticity. And let's pause here just for a short ad break. When we come back, we will discuss more practical and helpful ways, this time moving the conversation on for ways for dealing with grief.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well, welcome back. And we're moving on now to talk to Ben about grief. And grief is so personal. You know, everybody who experiences it feels differently. But Ben, after you lost your brother Sam, how did it make you feel?
Yeah, it's lots of different feelings. I don't think there was one feeling that you can say, oh, this is how grief feels. I always used to describe it when people ask me about, I used to call it, it's like being stuck in a washing machine on a cycle and you can't get out the door. And you were just forced into this cycle and it would roll you and rush you around and you'd be in this cycle and cycle and cycle and you couldn't open the door. And then suddenly it would stop and then you'd go on a spin cycle and something different happened.
Right.
And so it was like completely, it was always changing. You could never anticipate what was going to be next. And you had feelings of anger and then sadness and then guilt and then shame and then all these wonderful cocktail of emotions that you were absolutely battered with. But it was not a fun experience at all. This is why I think writing this book has been so profound in my own life, is because I didn't actually really think about a lot of this stuff until writing it. I'd had a few counselling sessions before with a lovely counsellor that did some really amazing work for me on my mental health. But it wasn't until writing this book that I sort of really looked at those feelings and how I felt and looked at how I went through grief and looked at some of the stuff that still affects me now and that you can pin back to grief. And that, for me, realising those things are connected and really and understanding that and realising that so much of this is normal, that's one of the biggest things. That's an incredibly settling thing to have done. And that's one of the reasons I'm really glad I've done it, because I like to call grief like my pet dog. Like, it's there. It's something to look after. It's, you know, it's something that lives with me, that's not necessarily something to throw out and reject. It's something to embrace and look after like you would a dog. And for me, counselling, writing this book, learning about grief was like taming that dog. So suddenly, you know, it can't perform tricks, unfortunately, but it can behave and you can have a little bit more control over it. And that's how I like to think about it, is a lot of people are too quick to with all sorts of mental health problems is too quick to reject them and to push them away and to reject them as part of you. But actually, if you can recognize that these things, you know, like you're like a pet dog, are not going away, they're going to sit with you. So just, you know, put out a bowl of water, feed it every so often, look after it, train it, and you can be happy living with it, and you can actually, you know, be proud of having gone through that. I think that's a really key mindset that only came about because of the stuff I did with the book.
I think that's an extraordinary way to look at grief. I mean, what a refreshing outlook. I think a lot of people going through grief will be really interested and helped and empowered, hopefully, by hearing your words. And you revealed in the book that you had remembered that your final words to Sam were actually fairly terse, and that led you to blaming yourself temporarily for his passing. What did you do to overcome the guilt, as you described it in the book?
Yeah, I mean, that was awful. And I realised that we had that argument before he died. So we had dinner and then I had an argument with him and then he went upstairs. And so after about a week or so later, I remembered that argument. And then suddenly it was awful. It was like suddenly I realised it was all my fault. That was absolutely horrendous.
Oh, because
then suddenly everyone that was coming around to our house crying, or my family, you know, everyone that you saw that was affected by this. Externally, I'd be like, oh, I'm so, you know, this is awful, I'm so sorry. Maybe even like crack a smile or a joke or something to cheer them up. Internally, I was doubled down with shame and guilt. And it's difficult to actually convey just how convinced I was. I was absolutely convinced that it was my fault, that I'd done that, that the reason this all happened because of something I said. And that was absolutely awful. And to be honest with you, that was one of the most... And when I said that this book helped me, I hadn't told anyone about that for 3.5 years until I wrote this book.
Oh,
I hadn't said anything about it because I was still so, so ashamed of having done that. I really hated who I was because I thought that I was intrinsically a bad person for having done that. And I'll tell you what, it took some work to get over that. It took some work to get over and to understand that. And what really changed that for me was the reason I didn't tell anyone about it, the reason I was still holding on to it, and the reason I was still ashamed of it was because I was rejecting it and was because I was pushing it away. And as soon as that thought entered my head, I was going, no, I'm not dealing with that now. And so I never really touched it. And the only reason I was ever able to rationalize it and work through that and understand that, of course, it's not my fault, you know, this is an incredibly complex issue, the only reason I'm able to do that is because I sat there for 3 months last year writing this book, and I chose to include this, and I'm very glad I chose to include this. And I sat there and I really, and when you read the book, this is literally the first time I was writing this stuff and really accessing this part of my memory. And it was such a incredible moment to just, like I said at the beginning of this, have it on paper, see it for what it is. And as soon as I wrote it out and had the feelings associated with that come out and I saw it on paper, I was like, there it is. That's what's been making me feel like this for so long. And then you can start rationalizing it and being like, well, no, this is a really normal part of grief. It's an incredibly normal part of grief. It's very, very normal. I think for me, it was exaggerated a little bit because of what happened. But as soon as you can do that, as soon as you can recognize those things, and for me, writing it down and seeing it on paper, that was a way of recognizing it existed. That was... yeah, I mean, I can still remember exactly that moment and that feeling. And I tell you what, the feeling of seeing that and the feeling of realizing it sort of wasn't my fault, it was on par with the feeling I had when I decided to leave uni. It was like, honestly, it was just utter relief. It was so, so good. It was like when you open a Coke bottle and it all just like fizzes out. That's how I felt. I was like a really charged Coke bottle and someone had just twisted my lid and I was just... It was just great, and but it came about just by recognizing it, and yeah, it was an amazing feeling.
Well, you obviously have a good sense of humour, and you speak in your book actually about the role that humour plays in dealing with grief. Do you think that people feel they shouldn't laugh? They shouldn't have a joke in the aftermath of any kind of tragedy?
I think it very much depends. Obviously, it depends on the person. If someone is a serious person and you go around their house with, I don't know, like a clown's nose on, I'm not sure that's going to go down too well.
Maybe not.
I'm not sure that's going to go too well. But for me, just a bit of lightheartedness. Like I said before, I hated this idea of ceremonial sadness. Like everyone's got to be sad just for the fact of being sad. And one of the messages I remember the best were the messages that were quite funny. Someone I know from school that I didn't really know too well sent me, like, she sent me the standard message of, "I'm really sorry to hear what's happening." This was literally the day, I think it was like one of the days after the news broke about Sam. And she sent me like pages, so many photos of her dogs and her puppies. And I was like, this is brilliant. But also humor, like, it's just,
yes.
I think humor is a coping mechanism.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes people think that, you know, trying to distract yourself is sometimes considered a bad thing. Like, you don't want to distract yourself because, oh, you're avoiding it. And I was certainly told that when this happened, a lot of people were like, make sure you're not like distracting yourself and moving your thoughts on, make sure you deal with things. Like, no. Sorry. The week that something like this happens, the moment this happens, have as many jokes as you want. Laugh with people, because it's your brain's way of just overriding your emotions for a second,
right,
and going, we can't deal with this. And it's a very natural response, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you were a caveman and something awful happened, you wouldn't want your brain to just shut down and focus on the bad. You'd want to be, you know, protecting yourself in the moment. So have a laugh. If you know someone well enough to, in a well-thought-out way, crack a joke, or... The best way of doing it is being self-deprecating, because that's not, no one's ever going to find that, you know, if you're like, oh, we can come around for a dinner, I promise not to give you food poisoning like I did last time, or something to that extent,
yes,
if you had actually given them food poisoning, then something like that, I think it's really good. Because I remember in the time I was desperate for someone to just have a joke with me, desperate, because no one was being funny and no one was being normal. And I was so out of touch with normality that I was being driven just into guilt and into grief, because no one was being normal. And I found that really weird. I was like, mate, you're my friend because you're funny. Why are you not being funny? So I definitely think that a little bit of comedy is always a good thing.
I love that about the puppy pictures. And in fact, there's a section in your book, isn't there, on the role that phones play and messages, I guess, here in dealing with grief. And in particular, you've got a very helpful section on how to craft a message to someone who's experiencing loss. So what should we keep in mind if we're going to be reaching out to someone in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, the first and foremost thing is I spoke to a lot of people at school afterwards, like I'm talking like year. Or a few months afterwards, and they said they didn't know whether to send a message or not.
Mm-hmm.
I would say always err on the side of sending it. A lot of people are quite scared of that, of sending it, and they're like, oh, you know, what's my place to send it? You know, I think it's really important to send a message, and to, because like I said, you have to make people feel safe talking to you and feel safe coming to you if there's a problem. And if you send a message, it might seem like just a banal, you know, a random thing to have done, but actually you're telling that person that you care.
Yes.
So I think I definitely do send one, but it's difficult. I think, you know, obviously it's a horrible thing to have to send, but I think just do what comes naturally. I'm really sorry to hear what's happened. If you ever need to talk, you know, I'd love to go for a walk or something. Also, the key thing that we do point out in the book, and I'm still spilling all the secrets from the book. Please do read the book if you want to.
No, I'm sure people will. No, seriously, we're giving it a very good sell. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we'll give much more in the book.
Yeah. one of the big things I say is when people send a message or talk to people, they often say, oh, if you ever need me, I'm here for you. Or if you ever want to talk to me, I'm here. That's obviously a good thing to say. But a better way of saying that is actually, if you ever want to talk, I'd love to. Put the onus on yourself wanting to rather than them.
Right.
Because people in this position are not going to want to force themselves on you, right? They're not going to want to be a burden. Let's face it, most people are super independent. They're not going to want to lean on people. But if you can change the narrative to, I want to speak to you if you want to, then that totally changes it. And if
brilliant.
You can say that in a way that's genuine,
yes,
like, oh, I know this really cool walk by the beach. If you want to go,
I'd love to go with you. Yeah.
I often go, but on my own, but you can join me. I'd love for you to join me or something.
Mm-hmm.
Make it you wanting to speak to them rather than the other way around. It's a really subtle change, but it absolutely flips the narrative on its head.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really, really good one to know if you're in that position.
Another area I think that you spoke about that you want to focus change on is the improvements in mental health first aid, particularly in school. Can you explain what that is? I've not heard that term before, mental health first aid, and why you think that's so essential.
Absolutely. So I think I was really shocked to find out that, you know, like I said at the beginning, the statistic around schools, 4 children in every UK classroom have a diagnosable mental health condition. That's a stat. Another stat is that 19,000, I think it's 11 to 18 year olds will be hospitalised every year for self-harm or self-intentional injury. So this is really rife. But I was so surprised that when you go and become a teacher, there are lots of different things you have to learn. Safeguarding, basic first physical first aid in case one of your students goes into anaphylactic shock. All these various nuances of how to become a teacher and what makes you legally a teacher. There is not a single mention of mental health in the entire statutory requirements.
Really? Staggering, isn't it?
Absolutely. And for someone, you know, if you compare, so for example, with the anaphylactic shock example, it's great that teachers are now being trained into how to, you know, administer an EpiPen and what to do in that situation, which is great. But if you look at, if you compare the statistics, in, I think it was 2019, 1,100 adolescents were hospitalized for anaphylactic shock. And we've compare that with mental health, 19,000 of people of the same age group were hospitalized for intentional self-harm or self-poisoning. Like, there is so much of a demand for these conversations. Mm. So I started a petition to make mental health first aid a part of teacher training. So the teachers would be statutorily required to have this training to allow them to legally become a teacher so they could address those problems in a classroom. Because I don't believe there is anyone in society that is better placed to recognise when a young person is struggling than teachers. So what mental health first aid is sort of gives you the ability, just like physical first aid would, to see when someone's unwell and give the very basic first steps to stopping them from getting worse and getting them the right help professionally. So what does first aid do really? It gets you to, I don't know, put a bandage around a cut and hold pressure on it and then phone an ambulance. In the same way, mental health first aid gives you the tools and the sort of the confidence to approach someone that you see is struggling and talk them through a crisis and then be able to signpost them on to better support. That's basically what mental health first aid does. Mm-hmm. I think that's absolutely essential skill for teachers, and I still do. So we launched this petition, and currently the petition has 314,000 signatures. I've been to Downing Street. I've met the Prime Minister.
Excellent.
Got a lot of support in Parliament. Yes. Dr. Alex George is in support. So it's still an ongoing thing, but I just think it's absolutely just such a basic thing for teachers to know in this day and age. They're so well placed to be given that training.
Very much agree. And I'll make sure that we put a link to that petition in our podcast notes so that everybody can go and sign up for it. Moving on from schools, of course, there is the wider community and the older people out there as well. What kind of signs should we be looking out for that we can perhaps pick up early warning signs of people that we know in our family or our community, our colleagues? What should we be looking for as a way perhaps to open a conversation about mental health?
Yeah, it's difficult to give you a sort of list of signs. I think most people know when someone's not okay. You'd certainly know when you're not okay. And I think if you know a friend or family member well enough, you do generally have a suspicion when they're not okay. But some of the things to look out for, if they're being secluded, if they're not wanting to engage as much as they usually would, if they're not, it's difficult to sort of put a value on this, but if they're not being their usual self, anything that might condone a how are you okay? I think I overuse that question. you'd much rather be annoying asking them all the time how they are than be the one that doesn't. So be annoying, really. Ask them how they are. And I think some of the things to watch out for are not engaging as much as they would, keeping to themselves a lot more. One of the biggest ones is not doing what they used to enjoy. So if they were a keen tennis player, for example, if they're not doing tennis anymore, why are they not doing that? If they're disengaging from their interests, that's sometimes a really good tell of when someone's either going through something in their life that is really stressful because their attention is being taken away, in which case let's give them some support, or they've got something going on that's stopping them from wanting to go out, wanting to engage with other people. So So, but it comes down to it. It's the whole mental health conversation has been blown into something that's very, very scary. Annoy people, genuinely. Annoy people with how much you ask them if they're okay. Have coffee all the time with people and like, are you okay? Are you okay? And the important thing to note here is if they say no, there is absolutely no responsibility on your part to help them in terms of clinical training, in terms of that. If someone says, if you ask the question, if you annoy someone to the extent where they're like, nope, I'm not okay.
Yes, then actually, I'm not.
Actually, you've asked me 50 times today already, but then just, you don't, some people, this is the reason people don't ask, because they don't know how to answer the question if it's a no.
Okay, so where do we turn people to for help if we get that reply that says, no, I'm not okay? Where would you suggest we point people to?
Yeah, so, I mean, in the moment, because often a lot of people may not need actual, you know, clinical support. They might just need someone to talk to just to get something off their chest. So the first thing is open your ears and be a good listener. The most important thing is to not... So many people, and I'm one of these people, I really, really struggle with this. If someone in my life is having going through a difficult time, or and I had this just not that long ago, if something's happened to someone, I am so quick to jump on the, oh, you should try this, you should do this, this is what you should, oh, it's fine, we'll sort this, right? And suggest things. And it's called, it's quite well studied, it's called being a rescuer and having a rescuing personality. So when you want to offer advice and offer, and you almost jump in to the sea to rescue someone, to take them out. But in the case of asking someone if they're okay, that's not the best thing to do. The best thing to do is ask an open-ended question. It's like, how are you? You know, are you okay? Let them reply with no, and then go, what's going on? And don't interrupt with suggestions and advice. Just let them talk. And if it's, for example, let's say it's, I don't know, they've just been fired from work or something. Just let them talk and let them talk and let them talk. And one of the best things you can do, and one of the most useful things you can do, and teachers love to do this all the time at school, is getting someone to talk more about a subject. It's very easy, because all you need to do is not say anything. Because when someone is talking about something that puts them on the edge or feels a bit nervous, when there's a gap in conversation or silence, people generally keep talking and keep filling.
Yes.
So if someone says, oh, you know, I've just been fired from work, don't reply. Just wait a little bit and see if they keep talking and they keep following that on. And then if they don't want to engage, then just sort of maybe ask a few probing questions, like, oh, how's that making you feel? What's going on? How, you know, how have you been feeling? How have you been managing to cope? Just sort of ask those questions, probe a little bit deeper. And then in terms of signposting, I mean, obviously there's the GP. GPs are generally very good nowadays at being able to talk to people and understand what's going on and put them onto the right support. They should absolutely be the first person to talk to if there's anything going wrong, because they are the ones that know better than most people what's available and what's not. Obviously there's a whole separate issue with waiting times if you are then in need of mental health support, but often that might not be the case, and you can be referred to all sorts of other services and other support places. If another great service just for people to be aware of, there is a fantastic website that not enough people know about called Hub of Hope. And if you search Hub of Hope online and you type in your postcode, you get or the list of all of the local mental health services,
charity,
third sector, private, NHS, everything comes up that you can then get straight to their website, because there's so many things that people don't know even know exist.
Brilliant. I'll make sure that we put links to that too. Hub of Hope.
Yeah. It might just be worth knowing. And it brings up everything, like very specialist things as well. So definitely one to be aware of.
And lastly, where do we find more about you?
More about me? Well, obviously, I've written a book, so there's quite a lot about me in there.
Yes.
And then I'm on all the social media. Instagram is my main one. That's where I do all of most of my stuff. So I'm on there. I'm at I Am Ben West. I'm Ben West on Facebook and on Twitter and on TikTok, I think I am. I don't know. But yeah, pretty much everywhere, Ben West will bring me up on the socials.
Brilliant. Ben, thank you so much for your time. That's the author and activist Ben West. His book, This Book Could Save Your Life, is out now.
Thank you.
And if you have been affected by anything we have discussed, you will find more information with links and resources, especially on ways to deal with grief over on lizellewellbeing.com. And if you're enjoying the podcast and would like to get in touch, you can find me on social media at LizelleMe, or the team and me at Lizelle Wellbeing. Please do leave us a review on your preferred podcast platform. It really does help other people to find us and potentially find the help that they might sorely need. Well, I'll be back next Friday with another dose of wellness wisdom you can trust. Until then, go well. Bye-bye. The Lizelle Wellbeing Show is presented by me, Lizelle, and is a Fresh Air production, with grateful thanks to my producers, Ellie Smith and Chezzy Bent.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.